Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand and New York, New York, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 2, Episode 22 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin reporting live from the Big Apple, and in the Cinematica studio are...
Hello, it's me, Simon.
And me, Kaylee.
In today's episode, grown-up comedies Your Sister's Sister, The Watch and Hit and Run, plus family comedy Finding Nemo returns in 3D, all that and more in today's program. But first... God, we're cracking on, aren't we? Not too much digression this early in the show. First, what's in the mailbag, Kaylee?
Well, it's been a lovely week on Twitter. Do I have my Twitter ready? No, I don't.
I thought Twitter was just on all the time, you know, in the background, like the Matrix.
It usually is at my computer, my work computer, but I'm a bit
You know, funny thing about Twitter, right, is if you actually looked at Twitter and said, hey, look, if you actually rang somebody and said what you said on Twitter, like, great cake. Would you ring somebody and say that? You wouldn't, would you?
And then just hang up.
But for some reason, through Facebook and Twitter, it's kind of like, it's relevant. I never understand that. Like these, yeah. But anyway, moving along.
But everybody else who has a slice of cake then just goes, plus one.
Plus one.
See, like.
But I'd love to see that one time. If you just got all these sort of tweets and stuff, and you said, all right, I'm actually going to ring somebody and pass that, like verbally pass it on. It wouldn't make any sense. It would just be like, why are you bothering me with this?
I can think of a few directors who could make some short films with that kind of content. It'd be great. Yep. So, exciting news today. Palace Films confirmed that they've acquired the Australian-New Zealand rights to Sarah Polley's extraordinary Stories We Tell, which Dan was talking, you were talking about last week. So, fingers crossed, it will be coming to New Zealand.
That was fantastic news today about that. I think that New Zealand audiences will get a really big kick out of it when it arrives. I hope that it's not going to be one of those festival-only gigs. I think that it does deserve a bigger release than that.
Oh, don't worry about the festival. Just get it out. Give it a good marketing campaign and it'll stand on its own two legs.
Mm. Get some Canadians behind it.
Don't wait.
I'm pointing to myself. Just a shout out to Trigger World. They had a little happy Friday and to check us out on Twitter this week. So thank you very much for doing that, helping push us along. Conversation between Miramar Mike and Bad Tom. Miramar Mike asked the Twitterverse, anyone got comments on Another Earth? And Bad Tom responded with, I loved it, went in some quite unexpected directions and was beautifully paced. So there you go.
That's excellent. Hmm. I got some feedback from somebody that I met while I was in Colorado who listened to the podcast after I handed some of my business cards out. And she said to me, hey, Dan, I love your format. The podcasts are dense as Christmas cake with info, only more digestible because your style is so light and breezy. Bravo. That's Susan Vibrock from Telluride in Colorado.
Oh, thanks.
Very cool. I like that. I like that analogy. That's great.
Too. Yeah.
And if you actually saw me in real life, it's probably quite accurate.
Can we put that quote on our website? Yeah. Can we use that in print?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And now the big news this weekend in the States is that this has been the worst box office weekend since 2008 for United States exhibitors. There's a lot of very nervous-looking cinema owners around America. What's it been like in New Zealand? What's the New Zealand top five?
The New Zealand top five this week. Dun, dun, dun. Huh. There's a lot of movement. Up to number five from 15 last week, we have Hysteria. Number four, still at number four, Total Recall. Sitting at number three, still at number three. Actually, I lied. There isn't movement. Sitting at number three, still at three. The Bourne Legacy, still at number two, Hope Springs. And at number one, The Expendables 2.
Which is in week two, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yep.
that was... Yeah, that was the big big drama here in the States, was that this was apparently the week after Labor Day, which is what this weekend just gone, is always the quietest week of the year. But this is the first year that there hasn't been what they call an A-list release, so nothing with a big movie star or a franchise or anything like that, and apparently they've really people are really suffering at the movies.
And that's a programming thing, isn't it? That's just a release pattern decision, you know. Those things can be resolved.
That's right. And apparently what was scheduled for this weekend was Gangster Squad. And after the Aurora shootings, Gangster Squad had to be re-edited because there was a scene that was sort of uncomfortably close to the bone. And so that film got pulled and is now coming out later. But nothing this weekend filled the slot.
And nothing put in to replace it. Yeah. No. So it's funny, Dan, what you were saying about here. And, you know, I think... across the New Zealand industry, it's been a tough time pretty much since, you know, not long before the International Film Festival, to be honest, and it's taken quite a while to recover. And I think, you know, again, that comes back to how films are released and what goes where. And it's, you know, we're a momentum industry. We require momentum to sell films. We require people in there to see the trailers and then come later on. And so when you have a really big kind of deep breath in the industry, you know, product release wise, it can have quite a long term effect, and it takes time to then build the momentum back up. And I think, you know, talking to a few exhibitors around the traps, this time this year has been very tough compared to previous years. And I do, you know, I suspect it's a combination of film festival and how the market's released product around it, and it's had quite an impact.
And also, it's been noticeable that a number of New Zealand distributors have pulled films from future release and decided that they're going to go straight to video. I was having a conversation with a few people today on Twitter, funnily enough, about Premium Rush, which is a film that's playing here in New York at the moment, which looked like it would be really interesting. And it's one of those ones that I was maybe going to try and see, but that one Sony have decided that one's going to go straight to DVD, Sparkle going straight to DVD. So it there's still a sort of skittishness on the part of the distributors too, isn't there?
Well, there is, but you know, there's so much product. I mean, I look ahead now, you know, to the next few months, and it's about how you can fit it all in, because all of a sudden 12 months has become 10 because of the way that things have been released. And I think, you know, what also makes a lot of exhibitors very nervous is this whole the massive costs that's going into converting to digital. And then you get these kind of periods of time where really it's down to how you release product. And at the end of the day, you know, an exhibitor is at the bottom of the chain. They get told when the films are coming out, and then they then decide, hey, I'm going to play it or I'm not. You know, it's good enough or it's not. But ultimately, you know, that we just take what we're given. And so you're very dependent on smart strategies and smart planning in terms of how you get your release patterns sort of worked out, so that you can maximize the result for that film and also maintain the momentum within the industry. And I think you know, it's a bit of a I think things could have been, you know, well, it's been a tough time, and really I think, you know, part of that's down to how films have been released and what goes into the film festival, I've got to say, you know, like, and what gets held back around it.
Indeed. Mm. Well, here in New York, I was really looking forward to going and seeing as many films as possible, because this is, of course, sort of basically the center of the art house movie universe. And it was a little bit disappointing when I got here to find that I'd missed one sneak screening of The Master on 70mm. That happened before I got here, and it gets released on Friday, which is the day after I leave. So, I'm out of luck there.
That's a heartbreak right there.
Oh, pardon me?
That's a heartbreak right there.
Well, it is. It is if you weren't made of stern stuff as I am. You know, it takes a lot to break my heart.
I would have had a bit of a cry. I'm not gonna lie.
You've been one of those bars for a bit, haven't you? Just sort of, you know, crying on the bartender's shoulder, and now you've moved on.
eating the free peanuts.
Considering I replaced that with a screening of Hit and Run, yes.
Yes.
It's almost wrist-slitting material. I arrived here last Thursday without having been to New York before. This is my first trip here. Didn't really understand the geography of Manhattan. Didn't really – like I was told that where I was staying was going to be sort of convenient for restaurants and bars and nightlife and a few movie theaters. And on Thursday night, I had a sort of walk around the neighborhood just to see what was around. I'm in the West Village, Greenwich Village, and I turn one corner and I find the Film Forum, which is one of the great legendary art house locations. It's literally a couple of blocks away from where I'm staying, and it turns out that they were playing Citizen Kane in the new restored DCP version. So I strolled up to the box, bought myself a ticket, and it was fantastic. Actually, it was for a film buff to see what up until very recently was Sight and Sound's best film ever made, and to just be reassured that regardless of everybody thinking that it's Hitchcock's Vertigo, Citizen Kane still gets my vote. That was a terrific experience just on my first night. The Film Forum is a non-profit sort of run by a trust. It's been going since about 1970, not necessarily in the same location. And I was very surprised to find that this place that had this massive reputation, as far as I was concerned, was just a little bit run down. And the cinemas, some of you listening might get this reference, but it just reminded me a wee bit of the old Rialto Wellington.
Oh, right.
Long, thin, with a small screen at one end and a pillar in an unfortunate location. And
I've heard rumors about that pillar. I have lots of friends who know that pillar well.
So while it was, and this is something that I've learned over the few days that I've been here in New York, is that the choice is absolutely staggering. There's so much going on. There are so many films that are screening in various locations that are unlikely, a lot of them, to even get festival releases in New Zealand because they're either so small in terms of distribution or production or what have you. But the cinemas themselves are not what we're used to, even from an art house point of view. There's nothing like the Embassy or even those new downstairs Embassy screen cinemas. There's nothing like the Lighthouse. There's nothing like the Monterey in Auckland. And I was talking to somebody tonight who is familiar with sort of the New Zealand scene and the New York scene, and she was telling me that there's actually everything gets so pounded. There's so many people here, and everything gets so much use that it's really not worth. She was saying that the cinema owners think it's really not worth building anything too plush because it'll just get wrecked, basically. So these places are sort of built to be sort of hardy rather than comfortable.
Interesting, because I always take the view that if you make it really nice and sort of like just smart, that people will treat it that way.
Unless children come into the cinema, then you have no hope.
Even children.
No.
But it would be an interesting experiment to do something lighthousey or something Monterey here in New York, if you could find a venue for it, and just see whether people a neighborhood cinema like that people would respond to, because the culture is so different. Even tonight, I was at the IFC, which again is just a block away from where I'm staying, which is a 5-screen art house multiplex, and it's very much the traditional movie going experience. You queue up to a window outside the cinema to get a ticket before you can even go into the foyer, which is fine on a fine summer's evening like today, but I was standing there in the queue thinking, I wouldn't want to be doing this in the middle of winter.
Oh, you get used to it. It's not so bad.
Is it the same in Canada?
Yeah, it is. I've queued for films. I remember one Lord of the Rings came out in like December-ish, didn't it?
Yeah, they've always been a Christmas.
Yeah, that was kind of.
Yeah, I queued for over an hour in December in Williams Lake, which is in mid northern British Columbia, waiting for those tickets. So you get used to it. You just have to have the right apparel.
You do. But it's a cultural thing that's quite different to what I'm used to. And the other thing is that the multiplexes all have kiosks, so you don't actually buy your tickets from a real person or even up at the candy bar or what have you. You just there are five or six kiosks and they're touch screens and
They're automated.
Yeah, it's all automated.
Okay. Yeah, that's how I would buy my tickets in Vancouver when I went to multiplex. And I actually usually preferred it, although sometimes, there was a person, a desk with a couple of people, and then the kiosks. And sometimes the line for the people was shorter, so you'd go talk to the 15-year-old cinema staff. But I prefer the computers.
It's an interesting call, that, isn't it? Because you look at what happens when you go to Air New Zealand and check in, and people have just been trained or educated along the way to just check themselves and put their bags on the conveyor belt. It's just a sort of, when it first was introduced, there was kind of a bit of an outcry, but now it's just so natural, everyone sort of does it. But I have to say that I don't like that, and I wouldn't like that for a cinema experience. I think it depends on who you're aiming it at, I guess. Yeah. But I still think, the personal service is key to the experience. It's one of the big pieces of the jigsaw.
Yeah, and also, if you're in a cinema that has all digital automation, your entire movie-going experience is completely hands-off. You don't have to talk to or look at a human being for, the entire time you're at a cinema. It's kind of scary.
I went to a massive complex in San Diego like that, and it was bizarre because there were no people. There were just I think, there might have been the odd person standing around at the start, but essentially you went into one film, and you could walk out. And you just walk into another one.
There was
nothing, there was no people anywhere, no staff. And I found that quite unnerving, actually. I didn't kind of like it, because it doesn't feel like there should be somebody sort of there to sort of monitor things.
We're pretty spoiled here in New Zealand, though.
I wouldn't recommend that to our listeners, though. You don't walk out of films and go to other films halfway through.
No, stick with it.
Stick with it.
The second film I saw was in a big multiplex on 42nd Street, and they had an IMAX screening of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Hey, and that made
you're just bragging.
But Dan, that made the top 10 or 20 releases in the US, and that maybe that's another sign of that sluggish week. But it was in there, so it must have been. It had a nice screen average from memory.
Yep. Yeah, and it was fantastic. And I noticed that there's a Spielberg celebration happening at Event Cinemas with a lot of his films being re-released, sort of in restored sort of DCP versions for some one-off screenings. But Raiders is not one of them, unfortunately.
Yeah, they're having the mini retrospective. I think they're doing it at the Embassy.
Oh, right.
Here in Wellington. Yeah.
Something I'm missing out on, which is a bit of a shame. But Raiders was looked and sounded fantastic. It was apparently only that pseudo IMAX, which is really only the equivalent of sitting up the front at the Embassy, not like a massive screen.
A LIMAX, as they call it.
Yeah, that's right. But interesting. All the same. And then on Friday night, I went to the first evening screening of Hello, I Must Be Going, which is Melanie Lynskey's new film, her first sort of film as a lead, I guess, since Heavenly Creatures way back when. And it's a film.
She was also in the Show of Hands. She was lead in that.
Right, yeah, okay. So maybe her first lead then in a non-New Zealand film.
There you go.
Maybe that's... Yeah, maybe it's the call. But anyway, she's fantastic in it. It's a terrific film. It's a film that I really hope gets a New Zealand release. And I was talking to her on Twitter across the weekend, and apparently there is no New Zealand distribution for it yet. It played it. It was the opening film at Sundance at the beginning of the year, and it's taken this long to get a US release. And apparently nobody for Australia and New Zealand has it yet. But I reckon it would play. It's certainly a long way from being the, I've seen a lot worse. Believe me, in New Zealand cinemas, it's a terrific little indie shot in 3.5 weeks about a young woman who's just going through a divorce and has to go and move back in with her parents who don't really understand her, and she has an affair with a young guy who's probably a little bit young for her. They're both their eyes get opened. But I'll tell you what was there were a couple of interesting things about that screening. One is the fact that it was at the Angelica, which is a brand that Wellingtonians are familiar with because it's the sort of art house brand for Reddings, and apparently they're the same. They're the same company, I think.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, but also their cinemas are in the basement, which if you build in the basement in New York, you're going to get the sound of the subway, right? And I know that I was talking to somebody today who said, that's part of the charm of going to the movies in New York, right? And it's like, well, actually, no.
yeah, but no.
So literally every 10 minutes, there's the sound of a train going on underneath. And every time it happened, I was reminded of John Davies talking about not being able to open the academy in Auckland because of the drilling, you know, the roadworks and it affecting the screenings. And I just thought, oh, John, you know, if you'd known what people will put up with in New York, you would have hardened up and opened up and put up with the sound. So there was that, and that was another cinema that was very sort of long and thin with a relatively small screen. It was also not a full – it wasn't DCP. It was like an e-cinema and quite pixelated image. So something that, again
– is a true basement cinema.
Pardon me?
It sounds like a true basement cinema.
Very popular, and one of the reasons why that screening was popular was that, and this is apparently happens all over New York every weekend for the art house screenings, is that there's a Q&A afterwards. So the director will turn up, the actors will turn up, and they treat it as part of the promotional process for their films. And so on Friday night, Blythe Danner, who you might know from the Meet the Fockers films, and she's also Gwyneth Paltrow's mum. She turned up to answer a whole lot of questions afterwards with the lead actor, Christopher Abbott, who apparently, if you watch television, he's in Girls. And so they sat there for sort of half an hour answering questions. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, Melanie Lynskey was doing the same thing at the opening screenings of the film there. And at this Angelica complex, they had three films playing at once, and there were Q&As for all three of them for wow. after the screenings.
Impressive.
Yeah, it was. It was, and apparently it's just like opening weekend standard practice. If you're interested in hearing from the director, then you pick a session that you know they're going to be at, and you'll be able to ask them questions afterwards.
Right. Nice. So. We should probably move on to some reviews, Dan.
Sure. Okay. We'll just knock off Hit and Run really quickly. I know, and this is a film that I only saw because I knew it was opening in New Zealand this week. And, that was a struggle. This is a kind of vanity project for this actor, Dax Shepard, who's been had cameos in lots of recent comedies. Anyway, he's gathered a whole lot of mates, managed to raise a bit of money, and he's written and directed this film called Hit and Run, which is about a guy on the witness protection program who decides to leave the program so that his girlfriend can get a job in Los Angeles, and so he has to go back to the big city. In the process, he reveals to her what his former life was, and he also reveals to the people that he dobbed in where he is now. And so it's a chase ensues. And you've seen this, haven't you, Kaylee?
I have. It's a chase in a very fancy Lincoln that he, in the movie, he's done up with his father, but that's actually Dax Shepard's car, because as Dax Shepard fans will know, and I know now that I Googled it, he is actually a bit of a petrol head. So this was definitely a vanity project, because it's him racing around in cars, mostly his own cars. Plus, his girlfriend is played by his fiancée, Kristen Bell. So I think the one thing that I enjoyed about this film was that their dialogue was quite heartfelt and realistic. Like, it's, you know, I heard kind of the way I talked to my partner in the film. And it was entertaining up to a point, and at that, you know, this film felt really long, but it was kind of a fun ride until the inappropriate rape jokes came in, and then I just sort of shut off. So,
well, you lasted longer than I did. I thought it was just leaden and unfunny, and I thought that Tom Arnold was just a complete
waste. Oh, I don't like Tom Arnold. Tom Arnold creeps me out.
It was just rubbish. And you know, if people are releasing films like this, may explain why the box office is so low on weekends, where it's like the main release. Do you have two words for it, Kaylee?
Just run.
Right.
for the hills.
Yes. Dan, do you have two words?
Run and hide.
Nice.
So, which brings us to another big sort of comedy. This one's got a lot bigger budget around it, bigger name stars, big studio backing. This is The Watch, which luckily I only paid $7 for because it's been out so long here in the US. It's 50% off. This is something that perhaps cinemas in New Zealand could learn from, is that if a film plays for longer than 5 or 6 weeks, it goes down to half price. Or maybe that was a judgment on the quality. Who knows? Ben Stiller and who else? Vince Vaughn and the usual suspects playing a bunch of ordinary sort of decent Ohio guys who form a neighborhood watch group in order to try and find out who murdered a local security guard. And what they in fact discover is that they're the only people protecting Earth from an alien invasion.
Typical. That happens all the time.
It does when Hollywood's ripping off better films like Attack the Block, which is what it sort of felt like. I really, really didn't enjoy this at all. You know, I have a very low tolerance for Ben Stiller nowadays. I have a greater tolerance for Vince Vaughn, but this is Vince Vaughn in completely lazy mode, like where he barely...
He's just sleepwalking, is he?
He is. He's just sleepwalking.
It's not the money. He's not the money. You're the money.
And in the, I thought there's a really interesting kind of surprise casting of Richard Ayoade. Like, what is he doing in this film?
He's playing an Englishman, and he's sort of deadpanning his way through it and looks a little bit embarrassed, to be honest.
Because in the trailer, he looks pretty embarrassed and out of place.
Yeah, and that would be a fair comment, actually. There are a couple of sort of fairly dicey racial stereotype. Not stereotypes much, but the whenever somebody of color, shall we say, and including him, appears, they're not treated with the same respect and on the same level as the white characters. And it just seems to me that it's just Hollywood lazy characterization, you know, and very poor. And this is you know, there's a subtext to this film which is about the diminished masculinity of the American male, and I'm sure somebody will write a thesis about it one day, but and that thesis I expect will be funnier than the film.
Yeah, it's funny because when I saw the trailer, you wouldn't have known that there were aliens involved. It's just them sort of cruising the streets doing crazy stuff. So, yeah. There you go. Might be a spoiler alert.
There's aliens in it. What trailer did you see?
This is The Watch, isn't it? These guys, you know.
What trailer? Sort of, there's aliens in the trailer. Maybe we saw a different trailer.
Well, maybe I saw a short. It was just this nice little short thing. It was just them sort of driving around in their car, sort of pointing at people going, hey, don't do that, kids, and stuff like that. But there you go. Yeah.
Anyway. Do you have two words for it, Dan? Or
anybody else who's seen it? Is this all up to me?
It's all you.
Your call. No pressure.
It hasn't
pressure.
Been released here yet.
Watch The Snore.
The Snore. Okay.
Wow.
Where are we? Okay. I have actually had a better experience at New York City movie screenings. Now, here's something that I saw last night that I know, Simon, you were interested in. I saw you watching the trailer before I left, and that's Sleepwalk With Me.
Yeah, I heard a... Yeah, I'm really interested in this, and I heard this great interview actually on Fresh Air with these two guys that made it, and so, this has got a bit of buzz to it, and I like it.
Okay, yeah, sorry to disappoint you, it's actually not very good. And
No!
it's a film that's based on Mike Birbiglia, the stand-up comic, his stand-up routine, and also an NPR show, This American Life, was an episode of that, and it feels like something that's an episode of something bigger rather than a film that will stand alone. It's only about 80 minutes long, and it sort of stops without reaching a satisfactory conclusion. And the
that's what happens when you go sleepwalking, you just wake up.
There are some funny moments in it, but it is a little bit unsatisfying. It is it's basically his life. He is a stand-up comic, and he has this sleep disorder, which means that he doesn't just sleepwalk, but he actually acts out his dreams in his in his sleep, which of course is, it could be incredibly dangerous for people around him, because if he's dreaming that he's in a knife fight, for example, then you could easily be awoken unexpectedly. So the so it's obviously serious, but it takes a while for him to take it seriously. And there's some funny episodes in the film, but in the end, it's just all a little bit thin, really. And everything I've seen here, I've been, including Telluride, I've been trying to work out, would this play to a New Zealand audience? Would there be some money in this? Is this a showcase film? Is this a festival film? Is this a film that you would release? And I'd have to say that Sleepwalk With Me, it's probably a showcase film, not much more than that.
Right. I'm still going to watch it.
I'm sure it'll be entertaining on some level, mm-hmm. But you wouldn't want any money in it, I don't think, not in the New Zealand context. And finally, a film that I've just seen tonight is a documentary called Detropia, which is about the state of Detroit as the industry, the car industry, collapses around it. It's gone from a population of something like 1.6 million to 700,000, and it's and dropping. And it's a documentary about how does a city of that size reconfigure itself, and is it even possible? And that was a documentary that I was really looking forward to. And again, unfortunately, just didn't really pull it off story-wise, and a few too many problems there. So while it's an interesting story, and I think that, again, this may be something that will show up in the Documentary Edge Festival next year, I wouldn't expect to see that on anybody's release schedule. So a bit hit and miss, it has to be said, this trip to New York.
Well, I mean, there's obviously an opportunity for exhibitors, by the sound of it.
Well, there's a lot happening, and I think that... everything's sort of interesting, but you know that when it comes to bringing something to New Zealand, and with the expense of buying rights, with the expense of advertising and prints and marketing and all of the rest of it, and the publicity that goes with it, you think, well, for the New Zealand market, somebody told me yesterday that there are more people living in Brooklyn than there are living in New Zealand. So, it's a risk, isn't it, whenever you want to take a punt on something like that. And that's why, festivals are important for making stuff like this available to us that's not economic to release. And I know that finding that balance between a festival screening actually doing harm to a commercial release and a festival screening actually being the only chance of seeing something, it's that balance that's hard to get, isn't it?
Hmm. I first met Dean not long after my father died. I was a young writer trying to take off. If Dean just raced in society, he had just married a 16-year-old chick named Mary Lou.
Where do you find such absolutely wonderful people? I've never seen anyone like them.
Don't do anything I wouldn't do.
The becoming of Dean Moriarty began the part of my life you could call my life on the road.
Right, that's On the Road. Simon, you're our beat poet correspondent for today.
Yes, thank you very much. I saw this a few weeks back, and it's based on the Jack Kerouac novel. It's directed by Walter Salles, who is usually pretty strong with what he produces. It's got a very interesting cast with a few cameos there from Kirsten Dunst and Viggo Mortensen. So there's a few sort of supporting actors there which pop out that are kind of quite interesting to see them in their roles. And in fact, they're actually more interesting at times than the leads, I found. It's sort of set in, a lot of it's set in New York, I think, from memory, and then there's these big road trips that these guys go on. They're all kind of very literate, literary kind of characters who are writing poets, and they're sort of embracing life. And I guess, where it's set in the sort of early 50s, it's kind of this liberating time when people do get that opportunity to sort of venture forth and see the country. And so it follows the main character is Sal, and he's just sort of recovering, I guess, from the death of his father, and he's a writer, and he meets this guy called Dean, who's just sort of, you know, every scene this character Dean sort of chews up the scenery and just lives life to the fullest all the time. And I think there's a line in there where he says, you know, I'm not interested in people who are kind of, you know, ordinary. I'm interested in the extremes. I'm interested in people who sort of push the boundaries and are different. And certainly, you know, this the character of Dean, he does this, and he lives life to the fullest. But on the way, there's all this carnage that just goes with it, and there's a huge amount of chaos and kind of you know, this sort of self-centered approach to everything that Dean sort of has. You know, he's in most things for himself, and so he has all these relationships. You know, one of them with a young lady called Mary Lou, who's played by you know, the Twiglet girl, Kirsten Stewart.
Twiglet.
So yeah, so she's in there, and she plays this young. She's like 16. You know, her character's 16 in this, and he's married to her, but then he also has relationships with other women and lives with them for long periods of time and so on. So it's kind of, you know, in a way, it's this film about, you know, excess. Everything's done to the maximum so I kind of found parts of it kind of, you know, quite interesting. I found other parts of it kind of, you know, like ho hum. It's just ticking along, and it took its time for me to get to where it had to be, where there's this conflict between the two main characters and the whole sort of genesis for On the Road is written, you know, and how that all this sort of cathartic process that takes place near the end, where he produces this amazing, or this book, which, you know, for a huge number of people is a very significant book.
Had you read the book before?
No, I haven't. I remember reading Catcher in the Rye, which I kind of, for some reason, I felt had this kind of connection to this. It kind of had this similar sort of, I don't know, atmosphere or feel, even though without the kind of crazy excess, but I think it was just that New York feel, or the way that it was written. So I hadn't read the book, so I couldn't say to you, you know, that it's the relationship between the film and the book and how close they are. But it has, to me, the film has pretty lofty kind of ambitions, and maybe if they'd pared it back a bit, just kept it a bit cleaner and not so to aim so high, they would have had a tighter, sort of more interesting story. So I kind of would give it a pass mark, but I was kind of disappointed. I was looking for more, and I was expecting more from it.
And I'll just point out to those people listening who are, and you know who you are, listeners who are constantly complaining about how long it takes for films to get from overseas to New Zealand. It's opening in New Zealand on Thursday. It doesn't open in the United States until Christmas. So, you know, I haven't been able to see it.
Yeah, interesting date too, Dan. I mean, yeah. I would have thought, you know, for me, this isn't a kind of Christmassy film. It's interesting that they've gone out with that date in the US.
Yeah, well, I think that a big factor is the publicity from Toronto and making sure that it got a big launch and a big North American launch in Toronto this week. And whereas in New Zealand, of course, played the New Zealand Film Festival, and they pretty much rushed it out, I think, in the New Zealand market.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. One sort of final comment, I think, is that it's always hard when you've got these sorts of films, when often a lot of the things that were considered very liberating and you know, like edgy and on, you know, living, so, you know, are kind of, now when you look at them, they're kind of like, well, you know, that's sort of, it doesn't have the same impact on than people from that, you know, that period. And whilst I think, you know, this was all about, you know, liberation and about expression and all these things, it kind of gets really bogged down in the excess side of it. And I think, you know, that would be my biggest criticism, is that it spends too much time sort of dwelling on that. My two words, it was Road to Excess was what I came up with. So there you go.
Kaylee, it's time for some news.
Yes, thank you. It was a confusing night of awards in Venice last week, as the Special Jury Prize and the Silver Lion for Best Director were apparently presented in the wrong order, and to the wrong people. A festival press release had to confirm that the Best Director Prize went to Paul Thomas Anderson for his hotly anticipated new film, The Master, and that the Special Jury Prize went to Ulrich Sedell's Paradise Faith, Part 2 of a trilogy. The Golden Lion for Best Film went to Kim Ki-duk's PETA, although a late ruling from the festival that no film could win more than two prizes might have had something to do with that. Scandal.
Wasn't it My Cousin Vinny? Didn't the same thing happen there?
Yeah, there's a legendary story about the about My Cousin Vinny and the Oscars. My understanding from hearing about Venice was that Michael Mann, who is the chair of the jury there, that was absolutely furious when it came to dishing out the prizes, because the jury were only told that one film could only win two prizes very late in the day. And apparently the plan was that The Master would basically sweep all of them, but then they had to choose which two would The Master get, and in the end it got the director's prize and, interestingly, shared actor's prize for Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix.
Excellent. Mm. And in exciting news, a little bit closer to home, on Tuesday night, Invercargill came to life for the premiere of the new comedy Two Little Boys. A red carpet event went ahead and the anticipated snow held off as stars Brett McKenzie and Hamish Blake and other dignitaries watched the film at the Civic Theatre. My man friend was there. He was helping projection.
Did he help with the installation there?
No, that was done by his man friend.
Right. How many men friends can you have, eh?
It's not mine.
Yeah, no.
Although I'm friends with him.
Yeah.
The film opens in cinemas across New Zealand next week, and we have an exclusive interview with the Sarkis brothers, writers and directors of the film, in next week's show. Woo. And the new Star Trek film has a title, Star Trek Into Darkness. After some alarm from fans, Simon Pegg, who plays Scotty in the film, had to remind people that Trek is a verb as well as a noun, and that the title is still completely grammatical and avoids the curse of the colon. The finished film is due out in New Zealand on the 16th of May next year. Yay. Yay, Simon Pegg.
Yeah.
I love Simon
Looking Pegg. Forward to that.
And a short piece of news, which I've added because someone told me this the other night. 80s, I think they did a bit of 70s as well, shock, horror, Trauma, some people may know this, they've released their full back catalog on YouTube, so now you can watch the full movie of Toxic Avenger and all their other awful, cheesy 80s films on YouTube, and I could not be more excited. I will put a link to that in the show notes once I track it down and peel myself away from the computer.
Your desk.
Yes. And Simon, you have some news as well.
Oh, no, I just came across a little article about digital conversion and how globally we'd reached 60% worldwide. And so, or globally or worldwide? Yes. Mm. And so it was just an interesting turning point in the whole rollout for digital and what that means, I guess, for the manufacturers of film as well, and how they're sort of cutting back and tightening up on 35mm and when that's coming through. So there's this big kind of conversion battle going on. You know, everyone's looking to the best way to convert to digital and the time frame with which they've got to do it. So yeah, it's just an interesting little stat there that we're at that 60% mark, which I think is a tipping point for a lot of cinemas.
Here in New York, Simon, of all the films I've seen since I got here, none have been on film. Mm-hmm. Everything's been DCP or that rather shonky e-cinema version of Hello, I Must Be Going. What was interesting? Oh, there are a couple of interesting things about digital. One is that I saw Hit and Run, and it made a big point of the fact that it was 4K DCP, right. Not 2K DCP.
Which is interesting because I watched it on film here. I watched it on film when I saw it here, and I was quite shocked that it would be released on film rather than DCP.
I think that we in New Zealand we still don't have quite enough DCP screens to because it, I mean there's a battle for them, as Simon will testify, you know, that sometimes you just need a few 35 mil prints around just to offer the flexibility. But I was interested in the fact that once you get to 4K, the makeup artists have to be absolutely right on their game, because the skin of some of those actors was not all that flash, to be perfectly honest. And the 4K does tend to reveal a little more than they might wish.
Yeah, I'm not completely sold on 4K. I'm sold on 48 frames. You know, I think that is the bigger sort of technical achievement with what's happening in digital. I'm not convinced that. I mean, you know, I think that 48 frames feels. I mean, no, 4K feels like a bit of a marketing ploy in some ways. Whereas, you know, everything that's in 2K is pretty rock solid, I think, you know, I'd be interested to see, Dan, what you thought watching stuff in 2K and then seeing something in 4K. If there was a huge difference, or was it just that it was a bit crisper and cleaner and so on? You know,
so. I think a lot of it depends on the size of the screen, to be honest. I think that once you get up to... I think that there are... My understanding is that Sylvia Park in Auckland is 4K, and that's a screen size that would justify it. I think that 4K at somewhere like the Embassy would be justified. I think... But, you know, in most locations, 2K would be fine.
Yeah.
Interestingly, just something I forgot to mention a little bit earlier on, but at the multiplexes here, 20 minutes of trailers. 20.
Wow.
See, that defeats, that just makes them kind of irrelevant, if you ask me.
Oh, you can arrive late. That's you know, yeah. You've got plenty of time to get there. It was extraordinary. And not only that, but they that's 20 minutes from the advertised start time of the film, but they have a pre-show program running before the advertised start time, which has commercials, it has behind the scenes on television shows, it has little mini documentaries. So it isn't like at 6:10 precisely the curtains open and the show starts. When you go in there, there's already something playing on the screen, but all it is advertising.
Yeah, I mean, that's here to a certain extent though as well, isn't it, Dan? I mean, we probably spend 15 minutes of pre-show stuff in a lot of cinemas.
Yeah, and I'm kind of glad, because I was running late for a film on Sunday morning, and because I couldn't work the subway system out, and as it turned out, I didn't miss the beginning, so you know that 20 minutes came in very handy.
My son was taken away from me.
Your son Chico?
Nemo.
Right, got it. Somewhere.
And Kaylee, you're our undersea correspondent for today.
Yes.
I'd like to be under the sea. Yeah.
I have to say, mostly I enjoyed this film because I finally got to go see a film with another person. Usually I go by myself. So it was really exciting. Someone else came along with me. So yes, Finding Nemo. Of course, it's about the fish Marlin, and his son Nemo takes Nemo to school for the first time, and he gets picked up by a rather ungainly Australian, taken back and put in a fish tank, and Marlin has to go on a trip all the way across the sea to get to Australia to save his son. And so it's a father-son bonding film, quite, you know, one of, because Pixar usually comes out with these quite heavy films, like about big issues, but if, you know, I'm sure most people listening have already seen Finding Nemo. If you haven't, in 3D, it's a pretty good way to see it. The 3D doesn't come out at you. It's more of a depth thing, so you kind of get that, you know, under the sea feeling. But it wasn't crazy. I thought Finding Nemo is quite a strong film, so I don't think it really needs the 3D treatment. But it is a bit of a little added bonus getting to see it again. As, you know, an adult now. And I think actually most of the adults in the audience had seen it originally when it came out. So they were now dragging their kids along, and their kids didn't really understand the plot, but the parents were just telling them to shush because they were enjoying it. So I give it a thumbs up. It's, you know, it's not mind-bending 3D, but it was really enjoyable. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing a digital version of it rather than a 35mm version of it. Actually, and the 3D is kind of incidental. I'm very much looking to seeing Nemo again. One of my favorite Pixar films.
Yes. Oh, and also, There's a great, they have a Toy Story 2 in short beforehand, because of course every Pixar film comes with a short. And it's great. It's about the T-Rex, and everyone calls him a party pooper, so he goes to the, he ends up getting into the bathroom somehow and starts this bathtub party with the bathtub toys. And it was just so crazy and so off the wall. And I was like, you know what? I bet you the Pixar studio in Vancouver, which they only opened, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago, I bet this is a bunch of Vancouver designer, like animators doing this, because it's just like crazy party fueled animation. And it was. So there's a little bit of Vancouver, BC in beforehand. So definitely make sure you're there on time to catch the short, because it's hilarious.
Sorry. I think I had the wrong house. And I hey, you're Hannah. Oh my God. I'm so sorry. I'm Iris's friend, Jack.
You're on an island. It's 3 a.m. and you're drinking by yourself. What's going on?
I just walked out on a 7-year relationship.
Whoa.
Hence the tequila.
I gotta say, not so terrible to have a drinking buddy. Going down, getting weird.
That's Your Sister's Sister. I want to apologize that we had planned to have an interview this week with Lynn Shelton, the director of that particular film, but some technical problems to do with Skype and conference calls and what have you meant that we weren't able to do that. But filling in is Simon, who's going to tell us all about it.
Big shoes to fill, but there you go. Another film that starts with the death of somebody. Like, this is... starts with this character Jack, and his brother's just died, and they're at this party sort of remembering him, and it's quite, you know, it's quite an intense sort of thing that the film opens with, where people are remembering his brother, and the guy that plays Jack, where is it, his name, Mark Duplass.
Yeah.
Mark. Yeah. No, he is great, and he's actually coming out soon in Safety Not Guaranteed, which is a cracker of a film as well. And he's supported in this film with, of course, Emily Blunt, who we all sort of know from plenty of films, Devil Wears Prada, Salmon Fishing, and Rosemary DeWitt, who I really like. I've seen her in a couple of films now, and I really liked her. And she was in Rachel Getting Married, and she's kind of often the supporting kind of actor, but I really like her. She does some good stuff. And so, carry on.
She's in The Watch, Simon.
Ah, of course. Yep. Great. Yeah. So she's, but she is. I don't know. She's somebody to look after, I think, or keep an eye on. And so, this sort of this get together to sort of remember Jack's brother, it kind of ends in a bad way, and his best friend, who's played by Emily Blunt, sort of says, "Hey, look, you know, you need a timeout. You need to just get out of here," and so go to our my dad's sort of beautiful place by the lake, and just cool down and think about, you know, it's been a year since your brother died and you're miserable and all the rest of it, and I don't like you seeing you this way. And so he hops on his, this is quite cool, he sort of hops on his old road bike, his little bike, and pedals off on this red road bike and rides to this place, and when he gets there he thinks he's going to be on his own, but he's not, and the Rosemary DeWitt character is there, and she's her sister, and things happen between them. You know, it's funny what a bottle of tequila will do, and they have a night of passion, and then horrendously the next morning, Emily Blunt turns up, her character turns up, and there's all this chaos that ensues. And of course, you know, Jack and I've forgotten her name in the film, but Emily Blunt's character, they are, you know, they actually really do, you know, they have a strong bond, and there's a relationship just simmering there, ready to break forth, and so she's really sort of reaching some milestones of her own. She really wants to commit to him, and he's looking for something as well. But then, of course, this brief interlude with her sister sort of confuses things, and it does have its sort of, you know, comical moments, but it also has its very sort of heavy, well, not heavy, but strong dramas in the film, and they all act it very well. They all bounce off each other very well, and I really enjoyed it. I thought, you know, and it's got some twists, you know, which I can't really, you know, I won't go any further on some of these things, because you've got to have a few secrets. But there's some twists in there which are quite nice and quite well handled. So I certainly think it's one to check out and see. Yeah,
I was quite impressed today because I was reading an interview with Lynn, and all of their dialogue was improvised, where it feels quite tight and it feels quite scripted and well done. The dialogue was improvised, and also Rosemary DeWitt was not originally cast, but the original person who was cast dropped out at the last minute, and they had to call in Rosemary, and she just fits in perfectly. So it's kind of a almost disaster, but turned into quite an incredible film. So
I think that shows just how good the bones of the story, you know, like I think that people can, gifted actors can improvise really successfully if they know that they've got a really good structure to work with, and they've got really good, really clear goals for their characters and clear sort of clear directions. I think that it's a sign that that the setup, the premise that Lynn Shelton created for them, gave them plenty to work with. You know, these are really, they're strong characters, aren't they?
They are, but it's very, you know, it's great. I mean, this is a neat film that's just pretty much in one place, and it's all just about how these characters interact. And so there's no distractions. It's just them and the way that they sort of portray these people. And I sometimes those films are quite hard to get across, you know, but this one does, and it does it really well, and you're interested in them, and you're interested to see what happens, and you're interesting, you know, you want to know. And I really like, you know, I love it when they do that with these films and they work. And this one does, you know. I found for me, my only criticism would be the opening scene. You know, I just found that a bit too, It just felt a bit really, really awkward to me, and I found it hard to sit through. Yeah, but I think that was what it was trying to do. So, you know, it still worked.
Mm. And do you have two words, Simon?
I had a few for this. You know, I played around a little bit. You know, I thought, you know, like tequila payback was one. Sisterly love was another. So I've got, you know, I got quite carried away on this one. I like tequila payback, though.
That's really good. That's really good. Kaylee, have you seen this?
Yes, I did. I really enjoyed it. How Simon was saying about being a character piece, basically. It doesn't feel the thing I will just to remind or let our audiences know, it doesn't feel claustrophobic at any point. So it's not going to be like Carnage where you feel you're stuck in a room or stuck in the woods with these people. Yes. It's very, there's a lot of breathing space in it. I don't know. Simon, I'm like you this week. I'm like, I don't know. I don't have two words.
That's right. And it is, I mean, yeah, you're right. Because there is a connection to Carnage in a way. It's a similar sort of film in a way, but it doesn't have that sense of claustrophobia, which I think Carnage did, you know, like, and there are long parts of it where there's just these people on their own, sort of doing their own thing. And maybe
my two words is open carnage.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with that.
Very good.
My two for your sister's sister are sibling sorcery, because it's kind of magical, actually, the way that those three characters work together and try and work their stuff out, as the saying goes. Yeah. You actually really care, don't you? It's not just that they're three interesting characters. There's that you by the end of it, you really want them to work it all out.
You do, and I think in a way, like Mark Duplass and the way he plays his character, I mean. Yeah, I thought his was actually quite a hard role, and I really enjoy watching him. And I really, maybe I, because I'd already seen Safety Not Guaranteed, I already had this kind of romantic view of him. So maybe, you know, my vision was a bit blurred. But yeah, there you go.
And that is our show for this week. Next week, I'm going to be in England checking out what it's like to go to the movies there. Probably pretty similar to the rest of the world, I would imagine. We will interview the Sarkis brothers, creators of the new Kiwi comedy Two Little Boys, as mentioned before. And we're also going to be reviewing the new Resident Evil film. I bet you can't wait for that. And more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or whichever software you use to listen to your podcasts. you don't have to be reminded about downloading them and to listen to. You can get them automatically. And also, it'll help you give us feedback at the iTunes store, you know, those ratings, reviews, etc. All super useful. And they help more people discover the show. You can contact us an enormous number of social media channels.
Yes, you can. You can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, or at our website at cinematica.co.nz.
We will answer.
We will.
Reach out.
The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some more music and a pretty last-minute addition, because not too musical most of the films that we've been talking about today. This is Robbie Williams and Beyond the Sea from Finding Nemo. So a bit of nostalgia for those of us of a certain age. Until next week, it's good night from me.
It's good night from me.
Simon and I are having a staring contest.
Who's going to go first?
Good night from me.